Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock, episode 391. This week, we're looking at questions from Guide 458 on the Japanese Navy's never-built Zipang design, the Wednesday video on Exercise M1, when the Royal Navy showed surprisingly advanced carrier operations in the 1920s, and finally, the Friday video on boarding actions, why they were done, how they were done, and when they mostly stopped. Paul Beck says, the Zipang reminds me of something I would have drawn at school. Did any other nations have similar naval design trips going on? As far as I'm aware, the only design that comes somewhat close to matching the Zipang would be the Habakkuk project. And actually, depending on which figures you use, the two proposals are actually very similar for size. The main difference, of course, being that the Zipang was somehow supposed to be just a conventional ship on a colossal scale, whereas the Habakkuk was more of a gigantic iceberg shaped vaguely into a pointy-ended barge that happened to have a flight deck on it, obviously using pykrete and so forth. So much as it's tempting in some cases to write off both projects as flights of fancy, the Habakkuk was the more realistic of the two. Theoretically, yes, you could try and build something like the Zipang. I personally wouldn't want to see the cost of it, but there you go. But anyway, yeah, Habakkuk is pretty much the only thing that comes close to it in size. There are some other very monstrous ships, but even ships that exceed 100,000 tons displacement, and there were a number of battleship and carrier proposals in the period the channel covers that do exceed 100,000 tons by a considerable margin. And, of course, modern supercarriers also tip the scales at just around about 100,000 tons. But as you can appreciate, that's nothing compared to the proposed displacement of something like a Habakkuk or a Zipang. Indeed, you know, something like the modern supercarriers are only about maybe a fraction over half as long as either of those two monster ships, which, of course, thanks to square cube law, means they're about 1/8 of the volume. Lesbienne Payne asks, since Sweden apparently tried to buy some Pensacola-class cruisers or the Alberico de Barbiano before settling for some Italian destroyers, how would you imagine those cruisers would have fared if they had been purchased? And how do you think they would have been refitted post-war, since Sweden probably wouldn't decommission something like that for many decades? So the consideration of potentially buying some Pensacola-class cruisers was part of the run-up to the decision that resulted in the Swedes decided instead they were going to build the Tre Krona class on their own instead of the purchase, partly because the Americans decided, actually, we prefer not to sell them, as well as other funding issues. Now, in and of themselves, I think the Pensacolas would have actually done okay for Swedish purposes, because they actually have a relatively shallow draft compared to some heavy cruisers, probably helped by the fact they don't really have all that much in the way of armor. So their draft at around about 20 feet is about the same as the actual Tre Kronas that got built instead, and the Sverige class. So they wouldn't have too many issues operating in shallow Swedish waters any more so than the existing Swedish coastal defense ships would have. So that's good. Obviously, they've got a pretty decent armament in terms of their heavy guns, the 8-inch guns. The only real problem I can foresee with the Pensacolas in a post-war environment is that, unlike the Tre Kronas, which were built in the early 1940s, of course, the Pensacolas were built in the early 1920s. So if we assume for whatever reason that the US had decided that they were going to let the ships be purchased, perhaps they decided they're going to do something similar to how they sold off two small pre-dreadnoughts to the Greeks in the 1910s and then use that money to pay for a new battleship, which is why there are three New Mexicos rather than the standard two for most US standard battleship classes. And maybe they went, oh, okay, we'll sell them the Pensacolas and we'll put that money into building another couple of brand new heavy cruisers, maybe topping up that funding or whatever. But there gets this, they're still going to inherit the ships, no matter how well maintained, with a roughly 20-year-old power plant, which is going to be pushing the end of its useful lifespan. As I've pointed out in other videos, generally speaking, high-power warships, roughly every two decades or so, need a full machinery overhaul or replacement. Now, of course, that does vary somewhat. If they've been involved in a lot of wartime steaming, that shortens that time span. And if they've had extended periods of inactivity, that prolongs that lifespan. But I think either way, unless the deal included a full overhaul and refit of the ships, including machinery, the Swedes would probably be looking at a fairly expensive overhaul bill themselves in the late 1940s, early 1950s at the very latest. And of course, the big question then would be the Swedes having to take the decision of, do we pay that very high bill to then keep them in service for another 10, 15, 20 years? Or do we give it up as a bad job now? Now, assuming that they decide, well, these are our biggest and meanest ships at this point, so we are going to keep them around, which would be a little bit ahistorical because, as anyone who studied the post-war Swedish Navy will know, they very quickly went down to kind of a destroyer-only Navy. Yes, they kept the Trekroners around for a while, but, well, they'd only literally just brought them into service, so maintenance costs weren't too huge. Then I think you can probably look at the Trekroners themselves for an idea of their general refit schedule. So obviously, if they're going to have a big machinery overhaul in the late 40s, early 50s, you're going to see a unification of all secondary guns based around Bofors equipment, which isn't exactly surprising. And obviously new post-war radar, updated fire control systems and the like. And then they probably would have had, again, similar to the Trekroners, another big refit toward the end of the 50s or the early 60s, depending on exactly when they have their big engine refit. And whereas their immediate post-war refit probably would have been mostly focused on standardizing around Bofors 40mm guns, the final refit would have introduced heavier guns, probably like the Trekroners with 57mm Bofors guns for long-range anti-aircraft firepower. And then they probably would have been decommissioned at some point in the mid to late 60s as their machinery would have been approaching another overhaul limit. And, well, at that point, the Swedish Navy probably either didn't want them or couldn't afford them. Although, interestingly enough, while they were somewhat narrower, the Trekroners and the Pensacolas are almost exactly the same length. T-Bone asks, what would be the sanest option for the German Navy in the 1900s if they wanted to avoid a naval arms race with Britain? Or at least what would be the option that would be the least likely to annoy the British? Now, this would have been a very hard sell, due partly to the Kaiser's idea of you need a big battle fleet to be, you know, a major power or a great power, as they were known at the time. And also, once he'd started building his fleet, his paranoia that the British were going to come along and blow it all up or steal it, which kind of led to this kind of circular reasoning of, we have a fleet, it's powerful, therefore the British might preemptively attack and destroy it, therefore we need a more powerful fleet to prevent the British from doing so, but having that fleet makes it more likely that the British will do so because it's a bigger threat, therefore we need a more powerful fleet, and so on and so on. But I think if you could persuade the Kaiser, but you were kind of restricted by Germany still has to have a large fleet and an impressive fleet by hull numbers and ship size, then I think the best way to go about it would be to form two battle squadrons. So that would be four ships apiece, and probably build a dozen ships to man to fill them. So you'd have six ships assigned, of which four would be on active service at any given time and two would be in refit or training or whatever. And instead of building full-on ocean-going pre-dreadnoughts, what you would build would be, relatively speaking, short-range, even by pre-dreadnought standards, heavily armed, potentially maybe fractionally slower, maybe looking at 16 knots, so you can slap extra armor on, coastal defense ships. And you would have these, the reason I said you have two squadrons is you can essentially go, look, we've got the Kiel Canal, but we have one to safeguard our North Sea coast, one to safeguard our Baltic coast. So one squadron per coast. Yes, in theory, you can combine them, but 8 to 12 ships is not a battle fleet that is going to challenge the Royal Navy's battle fleet in an open engagement. And especially if they're these smaller, slower, shorter ranged, but very heavily armed and very heavily protected coastal defense ships, they very clearly have a purely defensive mindset. And if you're really that panicked about the British coming to your coastline, well, you can integrate them with swarms of torpedo boats and such, but then they're still very clearly defensive vessels. Now, of course, these ships won't look as big or as impressive as everybody else's oceanic battleships. And so for both the size of ship and the size of fleet, the majority of the rest of your fleet would then be made up of cruisers, both general protected cruisers, but also do a nice line in big, impressive looking, relatively swift armored cruisers. And essentially what you would be doing there is you would have squadrons dictated by the number of German possessions. So obviously Germany is expanding its colonies across the world. So when Germany has its colonies in the Western Pacific, of course, that historically formed the East Asia Squadron. If Germany manages to gain more colonies in the Pacific, perhaps some in the Southwest Pacific, as well as enclaves on the Chinese coast, then maybe they might have two squadrons in the general Pacific region. They've obviously got holdings in Africa, both on the west and the east coasts. So you would say, okay, we're going to have a prestige squadron. So this is going to be our home cruiser squadron. And let's say at least initially an East Asia squadron, and either two small Africa squadrons or an Africa squadron that's perhaps a little bit larger, but essentially, roughly speaking, four squadrons worth of ships. And for each squadron, we're going to have two big, flashy, important-looking armored cruisers, because that means that, generally speaking, we can have one as the flagship and one on rotation. So the East Asia squadron will have one, the Africa squadron or squadrons will have one, and the home squadron will have two, and the other two from the other two will be at home. So that's your baseline. So that's your baseline of six. And then, of course, you've got to account for, you probably want a presence in the Mediterranean, kind of a roving squadron, not just for the Med, but also for overseas visits. And, of course, you might want a few additional ships around to improve the rotation, so maybe to keep your home cruiser squadron up at least two armored cruisers. And of course you'd have protected cruisers and other ships associated with it as well, but the armored cruisers are your big and impressive vessels. So if you added a third ship to each of those squadrons plus your Mediterranean dash roving squadron, so suddenly you're up to a dozen big impressive armored cruisers and all your various other cruisers as well. And I think that while the British would kind of be side-eyeing it going, that's a little worrying in terms of a lot of cruisers overseas who could cause potential issues for our trade, it's also not out of line with the way that other European colonial powers are doing their fleets. You know, they have an armoured cruiser or two out as a colonial flagship. Obviously, the British at that point have a number of older battleships out there as flagships as well as armoured cruisers. So by not putting older pre-dreadnought battleships or second-class battleships out there, you're not quite threatening the British, who do have those ships out there. But you've still got a good, impressive force all over the world. And if the British are concerned about commerce raiding, well, as I said, they do have some battleships out there. They've got their own armoured cruisers out there. It's not, as I said, unheard of. The French and the Russians have armoured cruisers and regular cruisers all over the place. And from a specifically British perspective, of course, once Fisher starts building battle cruisers, then the British would think, oh, well, therefore our problem with these kinds of ships is solved. And Germany is clearly looking at just defending its own coastline and being big and important in its colonial possessions. It's not trying to actively challenge the Royal Navy battle fleet. Therefore, we don't have to panic too much, but maybe we build a few more battle cruisers and maybe some more armored cruisers as well. The question, of course, then becomes, do you build battle cruisers of your own? Because if you do start building battle cruisers of your own, the British might start looking at you going, hang on a minute, this looks more like mirror matching. We're getting worried. Whereas if you built ships more like Blücher, so ships that are easily more powerful than any other armoured cruiser, but are still not 12-inch armed or 11-inch armed in the Germans' case vessels, you might well get away with it, especially if you said, look, we're just going to build a big flagship for each of our stations. So again, East Asia Squadron gets one, Africa Squadron gets one, Home Squadron gets one, maybe the Roaming Squadron gets one, so you build a class of four. But the British aren't going to be massively worried about them because they still think they have superiority. And bear in mind, before it became clear that the Germans were going to build Von der Tann, even after the British knew about Blücher, there was a lot of discussion about the follow-ons to the Invincibles actually being Blücher-Rurik-style 9.2-inch armed cruisers. And it was only the advent of Von der Tann and the realization that there were actually going to be other capital ship armed cruisers, capital ship gun armed cruisers out there, that made the British go, actually, okay, we're going to continue this battle cruiser line of development, which eventually ended up with the Indefatigables. Samoylenko asks, I'm writing a science fiction story with a ship that's in the ballpark of Zipang's size, although it's more of a floating dry dock oil refinery or floating city, and I'm very curious to know, what are the physical capabilities and limitations a ship of such a size will have? I remember in one dry dock you said that at a certain point a ship can simply start to collapse under its own weight, but perhaps there are other hazards? I also presume that such a vessel can influence the sea in some way, for example, creating calm waters in its wake for smaller ships to better weather a storm, or having enough free space inside to have an actual factory on board to repair and build parts for itself and smaller vessels. A lot of it's going to depend on exactly what kind of ship this supersized vessel is, because for something like Zipang itself, there's not a huge amount of space inside for other facilities. I mean, there is a huge amount of space, but it's also covered in a huge number of guns and needs a ridiculous propulsion plant. So while it obviously will have a far greater machine shop capacity than most ships, a lot of that volume is being used up by warship-like things like magazines. Whereas a ship that's perhaps not quite so heavily armed, so proportionally speaking has more of an auxiliary role, or like you mentioned in your story, is more of a floating city, that of course will have more available internal volume, at which point, yeah, you could conceivably have at least a small factory on board to manufacture things. So it would be relatively unlikely that you would have something like, I don't know, a full armor foundry and gun foundry for battleship grade guns and armor plate, because those facilities are quite extensive, even on a footprint the size of something like this. But smaller facilities that could produce something like anti-aircraft and secondary guns, or for cruisers and destroyers, main guns, and perhaps the lighter armor plate, larger pieces of machinery and so forth. The main restriction, of course, being that you're not going to be able to carry the bulk raw resources. You're not going to be doing refining and smelting and so forth. You would be carrying a certain limited stock of mostly pre-finished steel, which you would then be using largely machine tools and some forging and heat treatment to turn into components. And yes, a ship this size would be able to create a calm area around itself by either partially blocking waves or turning across waves and things like that. But in terms of major hazards, you're going to have issues like the fact that obviously any large ship flexes, but a ship of this size is going to be flexing in lots of different locations in lots of different ways in a manner that even a really big ship that by normal standards isn't going to be doing, simply because it's not under so many different loads. The stresses involved are obviously going to be much higher, not just because there's a larger area and a larger volume for those forces to act on, but because if you consider something like the center of moment or the center of gravity for a ship or the center of buoyancy, there's obviously a much longer length from there to another portion of the ship where the force may be acting, and therefore the force exerted on the ship's structure as a whole is going to be larger. And at some point with a ship like this, you get to the point where you're not even putting in steel to support the structure of the ship as a whole. You're putting in steel to support the weight of other steel. And obviously that you get a gradual law of diminishing returns, that's where at some point you'll end up just putting in material to support the other material's own weight. And that's when you end up with collapses. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that this is exactly where that limit is, but if you scale and scale and scale, eventually you will run into that problem. But based on that, you are also going to face some other interesting issues, again, depending on exactly how you are running the ship. Because if you're running the ship as, like Zipang, a relatively swift mobile vessel, you're going to have issues such as, well, if all your propellers are in the back, you're going to start accelerating the stern of your ship, but the front end of your ship is still, let's say, stationary, isn't going to want to necessarily go anywhere, but the back of your ship might already be moving, and you're going to get quite a lot of compressive loading and therefore potentially warping and crushing even, simply because different portions of your ship are going to be moving at different speeds. So like a really long train, your acceleration and deceleration curves are going to be very shallow because you've got to essentially get the whole thing moving rather than just, oh, we're off. And similarly for turns, I mean, apart from the sheer inertia of something this size, when you start a turn, you're trying to persuade the whole thing to go one way. And again, if your rudders are at the back, well, okay, the stern starts to move. Again, the bow may not want to, and then you've got a lot of torsion going on. And that's one of a variety of reasons why something like the Habakkuk project actually looked at a whole bunch of podded propulsion units rather than just a bunch of propellers right astern. But for a kind of mobile floating city that isn't expected to go particularly fast and isn't expected to undertake combat maneuvers, those issues are going to be considerably less. Of course, the other problem is going to be with the sheer amount of volume of the ship, you could end up with relatively significant machinery failures or leaks that may go unnoticed for a while, simply because unless you absolutely pack the thing with ridiculous numbers of crew, there may be compartments that people just don't check very often. BK Zhang asks, what do you think was the earliest possible time for naval aviation to take over, except at night or in poor weather, not accounting for delays in aircraft or doctrinal developments that were caused by institutional focus in other areas? Honestly, not a huge amount earlier than historically. I would say if there were plenty more carrier hulls being built, so perhaps if you hand wave away the Great Depression, so the capital shipbuilding holiday ends in with the first London Naval Treaty. So they agree to keep the restrictions, but the capital shipbuilding holiday expires then. So battleships are being built. And obviously at that point, with better economy, aircraft carriers are also being built as well. Then once you get to about the mid-1930s, aircraft, so 34-ish, I would say, aircraft have probably got just about the capacity, assuming that nobody does anything like go, hey, there's a bunch more carriers and aircraft around, maybe we should put some more anti-aircraft guns on our ship. But then at that point, the aircraft maybe just about have the capacity to be a meaningful threat against full-scale fleets, because that's around about the time you see the introduction of the first dive bombers that can carry meaningful payloads. Because let's face it, a 500 to 550 pound bomb, it's cute, but it's not going to hurt a battleship in any major way. Not unless you get exceptionally lucky. Sure, you can hurt cruisers and destroyers, but A, dive bombers certainly proliferate an awful lot more in the 1930s, and they're a relatively accurate way of delivering munitions, period. But as I said, you also start to see the first dive bombers that can carry something a bit heavier than a 550-pounder, like a 1,000-pounder, at which point you can actually threaten even big ships relatively reliably. So you've got both a decent number and a reasonable payload on the dive bombers, and then you combine that with the torpedo bombers, which realistically are going to be the bigger threat to battleships and so forth. And it's only really in sort of 33, 34 that you start to see the first flights of things like this. This is a Blackburn Shark. And these are torpedo bombers whose maximum and cruising speeds mean that even in decent weather, they are at least a plausible threat to a fleet that otherwise has full freedom of action. Because, of course, if a fleet is engaged with or about to be engaged with an enemy fleet, then its ability to manoeuvre and deal with an incoming air attack is limited. So in those cases, even older, slower torpedo bombers could still be a threat. But if a fleet has general freedom of action, so it's just sailing around and comes under air attack, torpedo bombers of the 20s and early 30s, their top speed and their cruising speed is so anemic, and the actual speed you need to be at to drop a torpedo even more so, that a battle fleet that turns away at full power actually will significantly eat into the torpedo bomber's ability to close. And then if you have a reasonably stiff breeze, so what on the Beaufort wind scale would be perhaps wind force 5 or 6, i.e. fresh breeze or strong breeze, you know, if a fleet is heading at, let's say, 21 knots full speed into such a wind, so you've got, let's say, a 25 knot wind coming into your face plus the fleet heading away at 21 knots, the attack speed of pre-1934, let's say, torpedo bombers, and even the approach speed, is so low that either in the worst cases and in worse winds, you might not be making any headway at all. You might even be falling back slightly. But even in more plausible cases against, say, a strong breeze, your rate of closure with the enemy fleet is going to be so low that you've essentially become a very small torpedo boat in the sky. And therefore, the amount of time you're going to spend in enemy anti-aircraft fire and the relative ease of targeting you is going to be quite a while. And that's going to have a very negative effect on your ability to stay alive and or deliver any kind of meaningful attack. Whereas once you get to the mid-1930s, at least in a strong breeze, torpedo bombers have increased their speed to a point where they can actually plausibly close in relatively quickly and get into an attack position at a reasonable pace. I mean, obviously you still have incidents like with the albacores up in the Arctic where you get really strong winds and you obviously somewhat faster ships and you still end up with the hilariously slow closing rates. But by the mid-1930s, there's at least a reasonable case to be made that aircraft can threaten fleets. But you would still need quite a lot of ahistorical timeline changes to say that naval aviation could take over completely. Jet Driver asks, Drac, can you elaborate a bit on the British carrier air wings in early World War II and the effectiveness or lack thereof of that air wing? My perception, and it may be unfair, is that British carriers were far less capable than their American or Japanese counterparts because of their smaller and older air wings. Why was that? It's actually a subject that would need either a video or multiple videos to cover. I'm actually planning at some point to do a video with Rex from Rex's Hangar covering the Fleet Air Arms fighters in the interwar period, because that alone is a topic in and of itself. But in very broad terms, partly it's the fact that the Fleet Air Arm was under the control of the RAF for the majority of the interwar period, and therefore tended to be the one that got the hand-me-downs and the lowest priority, while the RAF obviously prioritised its own land-based fighters and bombers to a certain extent. And yes, the Fleet Air Arm was independent by the time of World War II, but it was still recovering from that. One of the results being that even for the relatively limited number of aircraft that the Fleet Air Arm could actually field, given the carrier sizes, and we'll come to that in a second, during the early part of the Second World War, one of the things that persistently comes up is they just do not have that many aircraft because they haven't been able to procure enough pre-war. So carriers set out with space in their hangars, even with the British not doing deck parking, simply because there aren't enough aircraft to fill the hangars of all their carriers. And then you have, obviously, the actual flight group size. So this is complicated by two separate factors. Firstly, as I just mentioned, unlike the Japanese and the Americans, the British didn't do deck parking. which meant that you could only take as many aircraft as you could fit in your hangars. Now, of course, in the Pacific, in the later part of the war, the British do end up doing some deck parking, and suddenly their aircraft carrying capacity increases reasonably dramatically compared to what they could do previously. But this is compounded by the fact that the majority of British aircraft carriers are somewhat smaller because, at least in terms of the fleet carriers, they're either for the conversions, like Courageous, Glorious and Furious, based on significantly smaller ships than Okagi, Kaga, Lexington and Saratoga. And in terms of purpose-built fleet carriers, the Illustriouses are very heavily armoured and actually very heavily armed compared to pretty much everybody else's purpose-built carriers. And that means that within the treaty displacement limits, they are of a somewhat smaller size, therefore smaller hangars. And so if you have a smaller hangar and you don't do deck parking, your air group is going to be significantly limited compared to other nations which have chosen different design priorities. It's actually quite interesting to look at the one non-fully armoured British carrier that is purpose-built and designed before the war. That is, of course, the Ark Royal. And she is, compared to, say, a Yorktown, considerably more heavily armed, somewhat more heavily protected, and as a result, as in terms of standard displacement, displaces slightly more. But she's overall of a slightly smaller length because she's constrained somewhat by various dockyard facilities, which is why she has very significant overhangs for her flight deck. And even with all of that, her designed aircraft payload is not that much less, despite all of those compromises, than a Yorktown. But when she's actually in service, she carries a dozen to two dozen fewer aircraft than she theoretically could, again because of aircraft shortages, as mentioned before. And then we come to the aircraft. Now, apart from the numbers, which we've explained, there's two separate things going on there. In terms of capability, there are a few factors. Firstly, there is the whole two-seater issue with things like the skewer. That's partly due to Royal Navy doctrine, where they're thinking, look, we're going to have to spend an awful lot of time doing scouting and navigation, and therefore we need two seats because we need a navigator. Partly also because of restricted air groups, something like the skewer that theoretically can be a dive bomber and sort of a fighter seemed to make sense. The Fulmar, again, is also, you know, it's a two-seater because it's supposed to be both a fighter and a scout aircraft. But a lot of that is driven by the small numbers of aircraft that the Royal Navy is capable of having at that point, both in terms of budget and in terms of carrier air group size. Because, obviously, if you can only take, let's say, 36 aircraft, you could have 12 fighters, 12 torpedo bombers and 12 dive bombers. But then who do you get to do the recon? And is a 12-strong group actually worthwhile? Or is it better to perhaps take 18 torpedo bombers and 18 fighters? That gives you a reasonable fighter strength, and actually that would give you a similar fighter strength to early US carrier groups, for instance. But then you have no dive bombers, you have no scout aircraft, so then you would look for an aircraft that can do multiple roles. And then you end up with stuff like the skewer and the Fulmar. But there's also a huge amount of timing involved because, yes, things like the Devastator and the B-5N fly before the war starts. But then if you look at the production and introduction dates of those aircraft, they are actually realistically wartime aircraft, except the Japanese and the Americans have essentially about 2 and a bit years in which to produce and introduce their next generation of aircraft, whereas the British are left essentially with the previous generation of aircraft, because that's mostly what gets locked into production by the time war breaks out, rather than going, okay, we're going to bring in the equivalent of the Devastator or the B-5N, or the Avenger for that matter. The British are left going, look, we just need to produce more and more Swordfish and maybe a few albacores, and, you know, let's get those out there while we're fighting this war, and then maybe we can look at later aircraft. And, you know, for all the flack that the albacore in some cases deservedly gets, the Albacore actually has superior performance to the Devastator in some aspects. So if you look at the classic US torpedo bomber for the vast majority of the Pacific War, the Avenger, the British rough equivalent, the Barracuda, actually starts life as the initial design, the Fairey Type 100, in 1937, and the first flight of what eventually becomes the Barracuda, because there's a few design iterations in between, is 8-9 months before the first flight of the Avenger, so at the end of 1940. The difference is, of course, that the British can look at the Barracuda flight and go, great, that's fantastic. However, we are in the middle of a war, an existential war, so keep developing that, but please, you know, we need Swordfish and Albacores now, not a Barracuda in a year or two's time. Whereas the Americans can go, oh, you know, in the middle of summer 1941, can go, great, fantastic, Avenger, we like this. We will start ordering this to replace our Devastators. And of course, then the Avenger comes in to service about a year later, whereas the Barracuda actually postdates the Avenger going into service by another year because of those wartime restrictions. Whereas, quite plausibly, if war had not broken out generally until the end of 1941, the Barracuda would have been well on its way to replacing the Swordfish and the Albacore in the Fleet Air Arm. And yeah, you can make arguments as to comparisons between the Barracuda and the early Avengers and the B-5N, but it's certainly far more competitive. And similarly for fighters, although it's slightly awkward because obviously not everyone is advancing at exactly the same pace in terms of, oh yeah, everyone designs an aircraft in 1937, let's say. So the most likely, you know, brand spanking new fighter for the Fleet Air Arm, if things had gone in such a way that the main combat doesn't start till late 41, early 42, would have been the aircraft that was selected as a result of specifications N839 and N939. And that's something I've alluded to in several other videos, which was Supermarine 333, aka the fully navalized Gullwing Spitfire. And the reason why I say it's in a slightly awkward position is that that design specification and program slightly post-dates that of the F4F Wildcat and the A6M0. So it would be a fractionally later aircraft than either, but predates the F6F Hellcat and the various successor fighters that the Japanese came up with. So it kind of sits between them. So whereas the Wildcat and the Zero had reasonable production runs and were kind of mostly for the Japanese and fully for the Americans, the frontline carrier fighters by the start of the Pacific War, you could make an argument that the Supermarine 333 would have been present perhaps on some British carriers by early 42, maybe not in on all of them just yet, but certainly on some. And of course, you know, a fully properly navalized Spitfire would have been very competitive, if not significantly superior to Zeros and Wildcats. So essentially, even with reduced carrier air wing sizes because of the British carrier hangar sizes and their practice of no deck parking, if the British had had as much peacetime as the Americans and the Japanese, then the aircraft that would have been on the Fleet Air Arms flight decks in early 42 would have been easily competitive with, if not in one or two cases, perhaps superior to, the American and Japanese offerings. The USN and IJN still would have had an advantage in overall numbers, but as we said, you know, if the British had decided to go to the Pacific and adopt deck parking, even the numbers would have been a lot closer than you would otherwise perhaps have thought. And of course, somewhat counterbalancing that would have been the fact the British would have had more hulls. Warrant Officer Will asks, how much area was actually allowed for takeoff before an aircraft was considered to be too big? Like, we often hear about how aircraft carriers were too small to support the operation of later aircraft, but what does that actually mean? Were they unable to take off, or were there other factors involved? Unless you were looking at stuff like escort carriers, it generally wasn't a problem of taking off. Assuming you look at purely fleet carriers, most aircraft, even ones that postdated the carrier that they were assigned to or potentially going to be assigned to by some time, could take off, even if they possibly needed a slightly longer run-up. But you could always get a slightly longer run-up. I mean, strike aircraft, even that were contemporary with carriers, usually had to take off from near the back. And worst-case scenario, you, especially by the mid to late part of World War II and thereafter, you could use catapults. Now, jet aircraft are a slightly different factor because of the slow spool up of early jet engines, which means you absolutely did need catapults for the most part. But when an aircraft is said to be too big for a carrier, at least in the time period the channel covers, it's usually one of or a combination of a number of completely separate factors to take off. So it will be things such as, can you get that aircraft on the aircraft elevator or lift in British parlance? So is it physically too big to get on that elevator? If it is, that's a problem. Similarly, those elevators are going to be rated for a certain amount of weight. Can the aircraft, even if you can fit it on the elevator, can the elevator actually lift that aircraft at all or safely? Is the carrier's flight deck capable of supporting the weight of the aircraft when it's fully loaded? And is it capable of supporting the weight of the aircraft when it lands? Because obviously flight decks are rated only up to a certain amount. And speaking of landing, is the arrestor system, the cabling, capable of supporting the weight and inertia of that aircraft as it comes in? Because obviously if you've got a big, heavy aircraft coming in, perhaps reasonably quickly, you know, yeah, the tail hook is obviously designed to stop that aircraft, but are your arrestor cable systems strong enough to do so? And on some ships, there's also a case of bigger aircraft means taller aircraft. Can they actually fit in the hangar? More of a problem for the British than the Americans, but even the Americans would run into that eventually, especially in the early Cold War period. So weirdly enough, it's, you know, it's landing, it's storage, it's putting them up and down the elevator. What makes an aircraft too big to operate on a carrier is pretty much almost everything but the takeoff. The takeoff is probably the least of your concerns most of the time, at least until you get well into the jet age and the Cold War, but that's beyond the scope of the channel. Nuclear Jasper asks, you mentioned in the boarding video the lower decks wouldn't have that many options available to them given the code of honour of the time. This had me wondering, did the code of honour forbid crew and or officers from purposefully scuttling their ship? I assume it wouldn't necessarily be as dramatic as an open flame in a powder magazine, but perhaps some hidden away axe work that was slow enough to allow for men to escape out the gun ports, but catastrophic enough to make the attempts at stabilising the situation near impossible, with the limited means available to the boarders. Generally speaking, such a thing wouldn't be possible, but it could be possible, but it would depend very much on when in the boarding process you are, and that's kind of what rules it out most of the time. Because prior to the ship being boarded, the ship is yours, you can do what you like with it, including potentially scuttling it. But why would you do that if your ship is still operational? And even in a case where you were very clearly outmatched, the code of honour at the time demanded that you put up at least some resistance. A captain and crew who just saw an enemy coming and went, nope, okay, we surrender, or saw the enemy coming and went, nope, scuttling, they would not get a very favourable reception either from their new captors or back home. That's why you get things where perhaps, you know, a sixth rate is being tracked down by a third rate. It's clearly not something that sixth rate is ever going to win, but the sixth rate will still at least fire a broadside for honour, as it was called, before striking their colours, to show that they'd at least made an attempt at resistance before it had been pointed out that this was actually a very, very dumb thing to do. So you'd, prior to a boarding action, you'd be very hard-pressed to explain why you scuttled your vessel before anyone had actually stepped foot on said vessel. Then, while the boarding action is going on, you are, in theory, putting pretty much as much effort as you can into repelling said boarding action, and so diverting crew to go down to hack holes in the side of your ship, which is going to be a fairly involved and lengthy process, again, wouldn't be seen as particularly honourable by either side, including your own, because you're essentially admitting defeat whilst still actually technically fighting. And if you were in a position where you were going to be very rapidly and quickly overwhelmed, you wouldn't have the time to do any significant underwater damage to the ship. Whereas if it was a very prolonged boarding action, a back and forth, then it would be held, well, at that point, you clearly had a chance of repelling the boarders. And, you know, if you sent half a dozen men down with axes to hack holes in the ship, well, you're possibly responsible for the loss of the ship generally, simply because if those half dozen men had been up on deck fighting with the rest of their comrades, you might not have lost the boarding action. So at that point, essentially right up until the boarding action is concluded with a formal surrender, realistically, you should be fighting, or you're not going to have the time to do any kind of significant damage. Because, well, hacking through the underside of a ship with axes, especially if you have copper sheathing on the outside, is some pretty involved work. And any minor damage you might do can be fairly easily set right by the boarding party once they've taken the ship. And once they have taken the ship, you have formally surrendered the ship into the enemy's control, at which point essentially resuming hostilities by trying to sabotage the vessel that you're on, A, would be seen as an extremely dishonourable act for which you may be summarily shot, and B, if you did manage to, you know, spend enough time to hack enough holes in the ship that not only is it catastrophic enough to cause the ship to sink, which is pretty difficult in the first place, but also so catastrophic there's no realistic way of stopping the leaks, then the boarding party may very well, for your dishonourable conduct, just lock the hatches and leave and let you sink with your own ship. So, yeah, theoretically, you could do it, but practically speaking, no. Unless you were in a very bad way anyway, perhaps from an initial exchange of gunfire with cannons, and you maybe just helped the ship along a fraction, but that would be a very niche case.
Yokosuka Girls Marine High School training vessel Harakaze asks, related to a question I asked many dry docks ago, assuming for the benefit of the argument that Musashi survives until April 1945, Shinano is completed as a battleship and also survives, what are the chances that all three Yamatos sail as part of Operation Tengo, and how much damage could they have caused to the US and British Pacific fleets? So I think two major things you have to bear in mind is that if Musashi survives until April 1945, that implies that she isn't attacked at the Battle of Subiyan Sea, or if she is, the attack is very minimal, because she'd need to be able to keep pace with the rest of the fleet and then make it all the way back home, or at least make it back home for repairs. I mean, potentially you could argue at Subiyan Sea, maybe cloud cover means they miss Musashi and they, I don't know, they sink Nagato or Congo or something like that. Anyway, the main point is that the US now doesn't have experience in exactly just how much of a punishment a Yamato-class battleship can take from air attack before it goes down. The second important thing is fuel. So the Japanese had to find an awful lot of their reserve fuel to get Yamato and her escorts to sail out. If they've got to fill the tanks of three Yamatos, plus even if we say the same escort, yeah, finding that much fuel is going to be a problem. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that they do. So related to what the chances that they all sail as part of Tango, your biggest question mark is going to be fuel. What happens? Where are they getting it from? But if they're on their way, then you're going to get the first massed air attack the way that you did against Yamato historically. However, I don't think this is going to be particularly successful, because at best, they're going to be starting at stage one again. So kind of like when they attacked Musashi at Subiyan Sea, that's a similar kind of attack profile, except this time, presumably, you've got all three Yamatos either, in Shinano's case, built, or the other two cases refitted to have a lot of anti-aircraft guns. Now, yes, they're not particularly effective anti-aircraft guns, but there are an awful lot of them. And since it took most of the day to put down Yamato, with the experience of taking out Musashi, if in this case you've got three Yamatos presumably offering mutual fire support with their anti-aircraft batteries, and the US is kind of targeting both sides, worst case scenario is the US attack splits up against all three battleships, inflict some damage on all of them, but not enough to really particularly stop them. They just slow down slightly. Best case scenario, they spend most of the day doing a Musashi-style historical takedown on one of the ships, leaving the other two pretty much intact. Now, of course, this could pan out in a number of ways. If one ship is very badly damaged and going down, it might stick around as a very obvious, hey, come and attack me some more sign, to try and let the other two, get on unmolested. Or if all three are not particularly badly damaged, they just press on. Regardless, I think what's going to happen there is you are going to get the big battle line fight that lots of battleship enthusiasts have always wanted, because whether it's two or three Yamato showing up, if they survive the basically the entire day of the US carrier aircraft hammering away at them, then they're going to sail on through the night, which means that they are probably going to run into Admiral Deo's older ships forming a battle line, which is what had been ordered as a back. Well, initially it was going to be the stop line. Now, then it was turned into the backstop once the carrier strikes got going. And then what happens in that is going to be very much dependent on how everything shakes out in the air, because if the Japanese don't coordinate at all, then in theory, there's nothing to stop the carriers, having spent the night reloading their aircraft, going at the battleships again with another massed airstrike while the battle line engagement is going on, at which point there'll probably be some losses, either in terms of ships sunk or several ships damaged on the US side. But between multiple US standards, refitted obviously, and massed air attacks, the remaining however many Yamatos will eventually go down. However, if the Japanese are playing it smart and they say, hey, look, we came on a massive air attack yesterday, and however many ships are still alive are still alive, and this is our level of damage, we would appreciate some help tomorrow. If they coordinate what's left of Japan's air forces into a mass kamikaze and limited air cover formation, then they can't. The US carriers can't launch a mass strike, because they need to defend their own battleships. And if the US standards are going hell for leather on all of the incoming Japanese aircraft, then you don't want to be a US strike group coming into the general area, because it's very good chance you'll get shot up as well. And if the weather is good and the air threat is essentially neutralized on both sides, then, you know, best case, three slightly underwater damaged Yamatos, assuming their main batteries and fire control are working, could make a lot of trouble, potentially even break through the standards battle line. Of course, if there are three Yamatos coming, it's fairly unlikely that just the standards would be used as that line. The fast battleships might be there as well. But in either case, there would be quite significant damage, possibly one or two ship losses to the US standard line if that kind of scenario shook out. At which point, given the relative ineffectiveness of aircraft on the first day and potential losses upcoming, there's a possibility, an outside possibility, I'll grant you, but still a possibility, that Spruance might summon the British Pacific Fleet. I don't necessarily think they'd get in range, even if they set out the day before, for anything other than perhaps a few scattered long-range strikes at the end of the battle, but they might very well be called in to back up the US fleet and basically take the place of ships that have been damaged or destroyed in the ensuing battle line engagement. Classe Cornate asks, how well would the design study for twin 18-inch guns on the 1920s South Dakota design stack up against N3 and number 13? Such information as is available for an 18-inch version of the 1920s South Dakota suggests that essentially they were looking at a follow-on sort of class to the existing South Dakotas, although most of the additional changes that were being made were in terms of armor layout. So there was a debate between going with 13.5-inch vertical belt, as had been pretty much the case for all the previous standards, versus 12 inches of inclined armor, which is a figure that you'll see cropping up later on in US fast battleship designs of the 1930s, but nonetheless, the work on most of those designs was still looking at 16-inch 50 caliber armament, but that as there were some prototype 18-inch guns being manufactured, well, there was a prototype 18-inch gun in the process of being manufactured, they did look briefly at that idea as well. So with that said, unfortunately, the 18-inch armed version of the South Dakota, such as it exists in a kind of very, very sketch form, doesn't stack up particularly well against either the N3 or the number 13. But I think I do have to emphasize that that shouldn't come as a huge surprise, because the other two designs are significantly larger. So the number 13 is supposed to displace around 47,000 to 48,000 tons. The N3 is actually even slightly more than that, at about 48,500 tons. Whereas compared to them, the 1920 South Dakota design looks almost anemic at merely just over 43,000 tons. So if you compare the theoretical 18-inch arm South Dakota, assuming that no major other changes were made beyond where the design work had gotten to that point, to the number 13s, well, the number 13s have half an inch less belt armor and 1 inch less deck armor for the, exactly the same armament, 8 18-inch guns in 4 twin turrets, except that then the South Dakotas are supposed to be doing about 23 knots and the number 13s are supposed to be doing about 30. So they're marginally less protected, although I don't think that tiny difference would make any real difference when 18-inch shells are being flung around. And that number 13 can dictate the course of the battle with a 7-knot speed advantage. Now, compared to the N3, however, it's almost an inversion of what's the same and what's greater. So the N3 is only about as fast as the South Dakota at around 23 knots, but it has one additional 18-inch gun. But perhaps more importantly, it has significantly thicker armor. It's got up to 25% more deck armor. And the belt armor is not only thicker, it starts out at the same thickness as the South Dakota's in absolute fact, like 13.5 inch, goes up to 15 inch, and on top of that, it is in fact angled. So in the kind of long distance engagements that all three ships seem to have been designed for, the N3 has massively superior protection compared to either of the other two classes. As I said, slightly heavier armament, the same speed, so in a knockdown drag-out fight, it's going to win. But again, you know, these ships are 5,000-6,000 tons heavier than what the South Dakota theoretically would have been, so there's not a huge surprise. Of course, if they'd continued to develop the South Dakota idea and they decided to go with the successors to the South Dakotas using 18-inch guns, I think it's fairly probable the US would have gone with somewhat greater protection. But we don't know what exactly that would have been like. Thomas Dudkiewicz asks, somewhat on time, is the sea shanty 24th of February based on a real event? And if yes, could you tell us something about that event? Ostensibly, although it gets the date a bit wrong, the sea shanty tells a version of the story of the Battle of Cadiz in 1669. Which is depicted here. And this was a fight between a English frigate, although bearing in mind at the time this is actually a two-decker, it's just not a great ship. It's roughly almost 50 guns. And this is the Mary Rose. Not the Mary Rose as in the one you can find in Portsmouth. This is a successor ship. The Royal Navy had quite a few called Mary Rose. But in any case, this ship is verging on the line between being a big frigate or a very, very small ship of the line. She's escorting a few merchant ships, and some additional merchant ships show up and are like, hey, can we join your convoy? And the Mary Rose just says, why not? Oh, look, here's another ship. It's wandering along. This is called the King David and will feature quite prominently as the story goes on. And they discover that although slow, the King David has recently been captured by Algerian corsairs. So the Mary Rose rocks up and goes, yeah, guess what? Uno reverse card, you're now captured by us. Except the poor thing is so slow that Mary Rose has to take her in tow just so she doesn't fall behind. So this merry collection of ships is happily wandering down south towards Cadiz, hence the name of the battle. And it turns out that the reason these other merchantmen have rocked up and asked to join the protection of the Mary Rose is because, well, there's a bunch of Algerian corsairs out there, and two of which have been spotted on and off as time goes on. Then along comes the next day, and this is all taking actually place in December, and seven Algerian corsair warships are coming in, and the Mary Rose goes, okay, all right, you want to take me all on at once? You want to fight one on one? I'm up for that. And calls the prize crew back from the King David and sets her loose to obviously give her the most amount of men and the best ability to maneuver. And along come the corsairs, and they fail to beat the Mary Rose in a 7v1 fight. In part, it is said, because Mary Rose's captain adopts a tactic of only firing with half his gun. So every other gun fires, so he fires a half broadside, which then means that if another ship bears up to try and take advantage of what ostensibly has just been a broadside fired by the Mary Rose, she's got the other half broadside to fire at it. So there's an entire day of combat Not really all that much happens either side, except that the Algerians manage to go off and capture the King David. So most of the fight ends up being a 6v1 rather than a 7v1. Then the next day, there's a further action because the Algerians are like, oh, well, we didn't manage to take it last time, but this time we will. And no, actually, it turns out that they don't have any better luck the second day. And despite being much damaged, eventually the Mary Rose manages to drive off all of the Algerian ships. So the only thing they managed to get out of that entire convoy, which they thought they would take, is the King David, which ironically gets recaptured again by another Royal Navy ship a little bit later on, and then gets brought back to its original owners. Admiral Kempthorne, who commanded the Mary Rose during the engagement, was unsurprisingly knighted upon his return to England for his services. And also, in a slight twist of irony, given that this was the 1660s, when he showed up in Cadiz, because they were on their way to Cadiz when they got attacked, he took the Algerian corsairs that he'd taken off of the King David and sold them into slavery in Spain, instead of obviously the Algerians selling the crew of the King David into slavery. Neil Johnson asks, assuming that the Battle of Jutland was won by the Grand Fleet in such a way that the High Seas Fleet amounts to little more than a few vessels desperately needing months in dry dock and a handful of rowboats, how would this shape both navies in the build-up to and into World War II? A lot of that will depend on exactly what the British do in the aftermath of said battle, because you've got to assume that any kind of Jutland battle where the British managed to blow most of the High Seas Fleet off the water is going to result in heavy damage or loss to at least some British capital ships. The Germans aren't going to go down easily. So one immediate knock-on effect is that the British may very well end up building another class of battleship. So there may be some kind of intermediate capital ship built between the Revenge class and historically eventually the Nelson class. We have some ideas what the Royal Navy was looking at during the war. So, for example, you might see a run of four or five ships. Let's say the Royal Navy loses four ships, so they might build four ships in replacement. And those would probably, for the time period, end up looking like the Queen Elizabeth class, but a little bit faster and armed with 16.5-inch guns instead of 15-inch guns. And that was a design the Royal Navy was looking at in 1916, 1917. The fun part about that, of course, is that it means that come the Washington Naval Treaty, well, those ships are going to be well over 35,000 tons, given how close the Queen Elizabeth's historically were. So that might affect exactly what the terms and conditions are for the Washington Naval Treaty. You might not even get the Nelsons at all, because the other powers might argue, well, hey, you've already got your, plus-sized 16, in this case, 0.5-inch, armed vessels. But if the Royal Navy's then used its fleet to try and do something else, so maybe they've kept a small battle formation, maybe a couple of battle squadrons, just in case what's left of the High Seas Fleet tries something, but everything else is distributed, so large numbers of destroyers can go to help convoy escort work about a year earlier than they historically could be released. That's going to help merchant trade. And who knows what they'll do with the rest of the battle cruisers, battleships and cruisers. They could try and shoot up German positions on the coast to try and soften up the Western Front. They could head round into the Mediterranean to try and take on the Austro-Hungarian fleet alongside the Italians and possibly the French to try and bring an end to the war in that area, or at least significantly force the Austro-Hungarians on retreat. Because obviously if the Austro-Hungarians are forced majorly back, perhaps have to make concessions to Italy, then the Italians could be possibly persuaded to come and help against the Germans on the Western Front. The Gallipoli landings have been over for several months before the Battle of Jutland is fought, so unfortunately I don't think there's going to be anything further to be done there. But essentially, if the British have been able to leverage their fleet in some way, shape or form that significantly aids them or significantly impacts Germany in causing the war to end somewhat sooner, then obviously that's going to greatly increase the prestige and perceived power of the Royal Navy. And that might allow the Royal Navy to leverage that into more funding during the interwar period and perhaps a greater share of the funding during the rearmament period up in the run-up to World War II, because they can argue, hey, look, the army was stuck in France, fighting an unending war for 2-3 years. And then we came along, we annihilated the enemy fleet, and we broke the back of the German forces. And via whatever operation it is they came up with, we helped basically turn the tide of all the war. For the Germans, it's kind of a double or nothing thing. I personally think, given the way that the Reichsmarine and then the Kriegsmarine was built up, that they're more likely, given that they didn't really want to fight the Royal Navy up until the very last minute at the end of the 1930s, that's going to be an even stronger version. Because yes, they've been defeated and they might want to avenge that defeat, but also they were defeated, and going into World War II, they're going to be facing a much larger disproportionate force coming at them, at which point even the some of the things that the Germans did in terms of shipbuilding decisions and plans, they may decide, especially if the Royal Navy is being rearmed in an even more powerful manner than it was historically, to be a bit more placating of Britain, because as far as they're concerned, well, they tried fighting Britain in the last war, and with a massive navy, Britain leveraged that to Germany's ultimate defeat, and this time the British have an even bigger navy proportional to the Germans, so surely the same thing's going to happen again. Nathapron Hong Sharon asks, one of the favourite bugbears on the channel is an example of inefficient ship design that's partly caused by gun design. But what about the World War I British fleet? Only Britain and Japan used wire-wound guns in the Dreadnought era, and Britain did not stop using it after World War I. British World War I era guns were all almost 20% heavier than their equivalent German guns, with a German 15-inch 42 weighing about as much as a British 13.5-inch 45, and the British 15-inch 42 being heavier than the US and Japanese 16-inch 45s. How much more effective would each Royal Navy capital ship be, or how many more ships would they have if they'd stopped using wire-wound guns and used more modern manufacturing techniques? For example, if the Lions had been armed with 15-inch guns or had an 11-inch belt, then obviously they would have been a lot more effective at Jutland. Okay, a couple of important qualifiers. Firstly, is that the American gun is actually slightly heavier than the American 16-inch, that is in fact slightly heavier than the 15-inch 42. The other thing is that the German 15-inch 42, or the German 15-inch gun, I should say, is actually still slightly heavier than the 13.5-inch 45, and it's noted in comparison testing by the British that the German gun is unusually light, to the point that the British actually criticise it for having far too small of a safety factor. And if you look at other contemporary 15-inch gun designs from World War One, you tend to see that, yeah, the German gun is 80 tonnes per gun. Most other 15-inch guns either built or designed around that period are 85 to 90. So yes, the British gun is somewhat heavier, but if you were going to build a gun that isn't, you know, mildly worrying on a safety front, then you're probably going to build an 85-ton gun minimum. So let's say if the British had gone with pure hooped construction, they could save about 15 tons per gun. And of course, that's also going to translate into somewhat lighter mounting. So let's say they can save 20 tons per gun. So on a Queen Elizabeth-style design, for instance, then you can save, let's say, 80 tons from your armament weight overall. Now, that would mean that, conversely, if you were to look at the 13.5-inch gun, which is going to weigh 78-ish tons or thereabouts, you could, in theory, swap out 13.5-inch guns for 15-inch guns with only maybe a 15-20-ton weight penalty, but that is going to require quite a bit of other work, which might increase weight somewhat more, because you're going to need, while the weight of the actual guns and perhaps their mountings is going to be fairly negligible, you are going to have to make a larger barbette, because the gun is physically slightly larger, therefore the turret's going to have to be physically slightly larger. But, you know, okay, converting a 13.5-inch battlecruiser to a 15-inch battlecruiser, that definitely could be done, except for the one big elephant in the room, which is the 15-inch 42 was a very rapidly developed weapon. The Lion class aren't going to have it because it's just physically not available at that point. Tiger perhaps could have it, because Tiger is built roughly contemporaneous with Queen Elizabeth's class. So yeah, Tiger could be an 8-15-inch gun battlecruiser, if you like. The flip side, of course, being that Tiger is one of the less effective of the battlecruisers at Jutland. So I think that there could be a minor positive impact, but not a huge one there. The bigger question is armour, because obviously, let's say on the Queen Elizabeth or indeed on Tiger herself, what could you do with the additional weight? And it's going to be a slightly lesser weight saving for the 13.5-inch guns if they're made of hoop and tube construction instead of wire winding. But let's, for the sake of argument, go with our roughly 80-ton weight saving. Well, 1 meter by 1 meter by 1 meter a cube of steel weighs a little bit under 8 tons, 7.85 tons to be exact. And if you divide that into 1-inch sections, which is 2.54 centimeters, that's going to give you 39 1-inch slices. Let's round it up to 40 slices. So for each 7.85 tons, we've got 40 square meters of armor. And of course, if we've got 80 tons to play with, so 80 divided by 7.85 gives us 10.2, but let's round that down because we've rounded up the previous figure, so 10. So that gives us 400 square meters of 1-inch armor that we can apply to a ship. Now, Lion's armor belt, if we go from the front of the forward barbette to the aft of the aft barbette, runs for a fraction under 500 feet, which is about, let's say, 150 meters, because it's a little bit less than 500. So given that we're going to need at least two of these 1 meter or 3 and a bit foot plates on one standing above the other to give us at least a minimum height. The actual height of the belt is a little bit more than that, but again, we're being very generous. So that would mean we need 300 of our 1 meter by 1 meter plates to cover one side, because 150 and then another 150 run above that. And of course, we need two sets of that because the ship is armored on both sides. And that's obviously 600. We've only got 500, so we've already run out of armor. However, if we take into account the fact that a Lion-type battlecruiser's belt isn't 9 inches thick across the entire board, it's concentrated in certain areas, then, yeah, maybe just about we could add an inch to its armor thickness, which would give it a 10-inch thick belt. So a British 13.5-inch battlecruiser could either, if it was Tiger, have 15-inch guns, or it could have a 10-inch thick belt for the approximate weight savings involved. Of course, given the way that Lion was almost lost and Queen Mary was actually lost, it might have been a better investment to put at least some of that weight into upgrading the armour on the turrets, but nevertheless, if we assume that a bunch of that armour did go to the turrets, then yeah, maybe Lion isn't almost destroyed by Q-turret, Queen Mary may not be destroyed at all, so there would be some useful weight savings involved. The interesting thing, of course, is that if the 15-inch 42's weight comes down to around about 85 tons, the overall weight savings involved across the board might tempt people to try and put a ninth gun in, which would require the use of a triple turret. So then we might have a Queen Elizabeth with three triple turrets, and which would also save even more weight as opposed to four twins. And if she has that weight saving, then who knows, the Queen Elizabeth class might actually hit 25 knots. A.B. Coates asks, if the 2nd Pacific Squadron had its chameleons and Belfast had Olga the reindeer, what's the weirdest animal to find its way aboard a warship? I think that prize still has to go to the 2nd Pacific Squadron, because chameleons were possibly one of the least unusual animals that were brought aboard, at least if you believe the various reports surrounding their stay in Madagascar. As I mentioned in various videos, including the one on the 2nd Pacific Squadron, ostensibly there were crocodiles and poisonous snakes on board. And yes, there are reports from other ships throughout history of things like gorillas and pigs, and apparently, although I'm somewhat hesitant to believe it, the occasional elephant fetching up on board various ships. The thing is, if you bring an untamed apex predator of some description, or in the case of particularly the 2nd Pacific Squadron, reportedly multiple untamed apex predators aboard a ship, which is, of course, very close confined conditions, that's unusual on many, many levels, unless you particularly have a death wish, which of course one or two people on that fleet actually did, so maybe it's not that surprising. And finally, Andrew Kirschenman asks, I understand scuttling ships in the age of sail to keep them out of enemy hands, but especially in World War II, it seems that if one gets sensitive material destroyed, a listing and lumbering hulk could cause the enemy much more consternation. Do they try and board it, tow it, sink it? Is it rigged to explode like HMS Campbelltown, etc., etc.? So why did World War II navies expend so much time and resource to scuttle ships when they would have been useless to the enemy anyway? Partially, it's national pride. You don't want your ship flying enemy colours if you can at all avoid it. And, well, putting it on the bottom is a very good way of avoiding it if you can't make any further realistic use of it. Another factor is that it's not just code books and encoding equipment. By the time you get to World War II, everybody has various either technological edges or technological differences with everybody else. And while you are fairly confident that you have at least some, if not many, such edges over your opponents, you don't know exactly which ones you're in most cases, but you are confident they are there, and you don't want the enemy getting their hands on that kind of information. Everything from, you know, the mere existence of radar and how that might work and therefore be reverse engineered on, say, Allied ships, through to things like torpedoes for the Japanese or all sorts of other things like that. Because you don't know exactly what the enemy is going to find particularly useful, the safest course of action is to just get rid of all of it, and that means disposing of the entire ship if you can't take it home with you. And there's also salvage, because if an enemy does capture your ship, apart from the propaganda value which we mentioned at the beginning, the simple fact is, yes, it is difficult to turn an enemy vessel around in World War II compared to the Age of Sail, because obviously you've got all sorts of different spare parts, different engineering principles and stuff, but it's not impossible. And any large warship is somewhat useful. I mean, let's be fair, for someone like the Germans, they're probably not that worried about the Royal Navy adding yet another destroyer to their collection, but they're probably more driven by the intel and prestige issues. But certainly when it comes to the Allies, when they know that, say, the Germans or the Japanese, etc., are a little bit lacking in escorts, there's no point in essentially handing them a few additional escorts on a platter if you can sink those escorts and deny them the use to the enemy. And it gets even worse for larger ships, like, for example, with Hornet. Yes, the Americans had concluded Hornet was probably gone, but they had to abandon her after trying to sink her because the Japanese were closing in. And when the Japanese found Hornet, yeah, eventually they agreed with the American assessment and sent her to the bottom. But if the Americans had just gone, actually, you know what, she's probably doomed, we'll just let her sink and leave the Japanese to worry about it when she looms up out of the gloom, and they hadn't put that additional effort in, there's a borderline chance that since the Japanese had control of the ocean at that point, they might have turned around and said, or the local environment at least, they could have turned around and just gone, okay, well, let's give it a go, tying it back, get some damage crews on board. And given how tough Yorktown-class carriers are, there's a non-zero chance they might have been able to stabilise Hornet just enough to get her to somewhere like Rabaul to patch her up and take her home. And, okay, yeah, the Japanese having an extra carrier isn't going to change the overall outcome of the war decisively, especially since even in the most optimistic of circumstances, they're not going to get her online until late 1943. But the amount of damage Hornet could do under the flag of the Rising Sun to US air groups and carriers and so forth, even if it doesn't mean the Japanese win the war, is still more than enough justification for the attempt to scuttle her. And that brings us to the end of this week's dry dock. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.